BF.org.
Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Dolores Handy. Tonight, the fourth in our series of two-hour special programs from the International Conference, Global Health, A Bridge to the Future. Recently, a small group of global leaders in health and development met at Boston University to consider the future of health. The conference approached the topic from four thematic areas: creativity, identity, urbanization, and institutions. Tonight, we hear excerpts from Session 5, titled Institutions. We begin with an introduction by moderator Jim DeWar, director of the Rand Pardee Center.
I wanted to say that I really am enjoying this conference. I don't know about you, but my brain has rarely worked so hard and energetically as it at other conferences as it has here. As a mathematician, I noticed we have the largest number of speakers in this session, so my moderation is going to be very minimalist. I'd like to apologize in advance to the speakers for not giving them a proper introduction. I'd also like to apologize to those speakers who I'm likely to do violence to the pronunciation of their names. But beyond that, I'm glad to finally get down to institutions because it's the one where I have at least some simplified framework for thinking about institutions, global health, and 2050. To my mind, global health is a global public good. It will be undersupplied by even a more globalized market. If you look at the national level, the national public goods are supplied by a national government. The analog would be for global public goods to have a global government. We don't have that. By 2050, should we have it? Do we want it? If not, what are the institutional alternatives? We have institutions now that are working part of the problem. Are they the right institutions? Do we just need to plus them up? Do we need different institutions? How do we look at this institutionally as a way to provide the global public good of global health? Seema is the only one who will be talking about non-governmental organizations. Seema.
Thank you for inviting me to join you for this very important conference. It is a pleasure to be with people who are committed to providing healthcare globally with the principle of justice and equality. Before I talk more about the role of NGOs in reducing and eliminating disparities in health, I want to address the meaning of health and the realities in most of the poor countries, such as Afghanistan. Access to healthcare is a basic human right. Providing healthcare to the people is part of the basic social services to which everyone should be entitled. Without good health for the people, especially for women, human security and peace are not possible. Health does not mean that you simply can walk. Health means that you should have access to enough food, social justice, equality, freedom from discrimination, and a healthy environment to live, human security, and finally access to adequate health facilities. If the women are not healthy in society, the family will not be healthy, the nation will not be healthy, and ultimately the world will not be healthy for humanity. Not having active war in a country is not the only measure of security. We see in every report that maternal and child mortality and morbidity are high in some countries, which is a hidden war against the lives of more than half of the world human body. Women are the primary victim in most of the countries when healthcare facilities are not adequate. If the mother is not healthy, the child will not born healthy. With a sickly population, every kind of crime in the society is possible. As we all know, with the globalized world, we cannot keep the sickness in the boundary walls of our country. It will reach everywhere. Example of these global health tragedies are HIV/AIDS, bird flu, and drugs. Afghanistan is an example of how health for women in peace or sickness in war are very closely connected. One of the reasons that we had such a long-lasting and violent war in Afghanistan is that it was not a healthy society. Basic social services, social justice, education, and health care for the people did not exist. As a result of poverty, lack of education, lack of social justice, and discriminatory policies played a big role in the conflict. Poverty and lack of education does not provide a good environment for peace and human security. The terrorism, fundamentalism, and opium production and transportation in Afghanistan have created a lot of problems for the world. These destructive forces have their roots in poverty and conflict. I'm coming from a country where 1,600 women die per 100,000 live births, which is the highest maternal mortality in the world. It is a country where polio is still prevalent. Measles and other childhood diseases kill many children each year. At least 95% of the people do not have access to clean water and sanitation. Preventable infectious diseases are taking the life of hundreds of the people. 90% of the population live on less than $1 per day. In Afghanistan, women's health suffers from decades of neglect. Millions of women have gone their entire lives without seeing a doctor and do not have any information about their bodies and reproductive health care. Not only did the fundamentalists deny women's health care, but the international community and NGOs until recently show no interest in it. Women who stay in Afghanistan suffered very badly from restriction and lack of facilities, which were the result of conflict and misuse of religion by the warring faction. Women had no access to birth control, and it was all but impossible for women to receive medical treatment because of the war. In addition, Afghanistan has never had enough medical staff, and then many of the medical professionals had to flee the country for their safety. The situation for Afghan women refugees in Pakistan was not much better. Clinics in refugee camps were not proper clinics. They hardly had any female staff, and virtually no reproductive health care was available. There was little transportation to even the limited facilities far away in the cities. Many women would die on the way to hospital. There was very little education at all among refugee women, especially about reproductive health. International NGOs were not interested in providing reproductive health care to women, claiming respect for culture and religion. I want to offer several recommendations. First, good governance, accountability, transparency, and the political will to provide health care for all are essential. Corruption is an obstacle to providing health care, whether it is corrupt government official or corrupt NGOs. Unfortunately, most of the governments are spending most of the money on military activities rather than on health and education. Second, national human rights institutions, NGOs, and governments need to treat women's health care as a basic human right. In the least developed countries, such as Afghanistan, human rights instruments, education can be powerful tools for health care and women's health. Massive public awareness about women's rights and human rights is necessary. Women need to know that their human rights include access to health care. Men need to be educated that women have the rights and that women's rights should be respected. Third, there also is a great need for program by NGOs that provide education among the women of reproductive health, literacy training, and access to contraception. The women have to learn that smaller family result in better health for themselves and their children, better economic condition, and more chances for their children to be educated. Having information will play an important role in improving their daily lives. Fourth, in Afghanistan and other post-conflict countries, much more work is needed to secure reproductive health care for women. In our country, during the war, NGOs did provide the basic health care in the most of the rural areas, but with some error, and nobody was interested in providing family planning or contraceptive to women. Now that there is so-called peace, the construction, repair, upgrading of health care facilities, especially gynecological services, is necessary, but there must be coordination and long-term planning among the NGOs, donors, and government. Just building clinics and hospitals is not enough. Empty buildings cannot provide health care. Long after the media takes photograph of the new building for the donors, the clinics and hospitals need to have staffs, equipment, and medicine if people are to receive real and ongoing medical treatment. In our country, we have a lack of trained staff, There's also a competition among the local NGOs and the national NGOs and the government for the few trained nurses and doctors. If countries such as Afghanistan are to rebuild their health infrastructure, funds must be contributed for the training of medical staff. In most of the least developed countries, a major problem has been that those in power favor their own ethnic group and their own region. Fifth, privatization of healthcare should not be forced on post-conflict countries like Afghanistan. In the poor countries, most people cannot afford to have access to health facilities. A better policy would be to have at least the basic health services provided for free to the public. Better coordination among the different actors and NGOs in the healthcare system is really needed. Negative competition in providing healthcare should be stopped. Sometimes the competition between the healthcare provider victimizes the public, and especially women. Sixth, it has to be seen as a global issue, and the strategy should be based more on humanity and global human health security. As I mentioned before, we cannot stop the health problems or generally the human problem only within our boundaries. Health issues are connected to all other problems in the world, such as lack of education, poverty, terrorism, and fundamentalism. None of these should be seen as isolated issues or problems. We have to wonder why we have more suicide bombs now in more other countries than any other time in the history. This a sickness of which we should find a cause and try to prevent. And finally, providing healthcare is a political issue. Without real democracy and participation of the people, healthcare will not work effectively. The people in Afghanistan who suffer from disease are part of human global body. If they are suffering, the other part of the body will be disturbed. Let us hope for a healthier world in which there is equality, justice, peace, and real security. Once again, thank you for the opportunity to be with you today. Thank you for listening.
The next kind of organization which we'll talk about are the National Research Institutes. We're going to start with Stephen Matlin, and then go to Nirmal Ganguly, and then Malagapuru Magopa, and finally Jaime Sepulveda. So in that order, I present them to you.
I'm going to talk about institutions, but I want to put that in the context of the major current trends in global health and what I see as some of the challenges and some of the possible ways forward. There are huge concerns now about a variety of health issues, many of which are being driven by threats of pandemic infectious diseases. This is not entirely without some justification. There have been more than 30 new pathogenic diseases detected for the first time in human beings since about 1970. So virtually one a year turning up, and some of them like Ebola, like SARS, like HIV, certainly extremely serious conditions. But meanwhile, of course, Africa is still dominated by long-known infectious diseases, and life expectancy is decreasing. And we're also seeing a new pandemic appearing in the developing world, that of non-communicable diseases, which are now extensively affecting low- and middle-income countries. One of the things that we take a strong interest in the Global Forum for Health Research is what the world spends on health research each year, believing that more health research can help to solve some of these underlying global health problems. The first attempt to measure what the world spent on health research was carried out by the Commission on Health Research for Development, and they reported that for 1986 the world spent a total of about $30 billion on health research, and they estimated that only about 5% of that was being applied to research on health specifically for low and middle income country needs. That huge imbalance gave rise to the term the 10-90 gap. And since then, the amount that the world spends on health research has risen very steeply, and it now stands, or it stood in 2001, I should say, at about $106 billion. You'll see that the rate of increase has gone up significantly during that period of time, as well as the total, and during the last 3 years for which we've collected data, the average rate of increase is an additional $7 billion a year of global health research spending. So where does this money go, and how much is being spent on the real problems? Well, there's clearly a large, still unfinished agenda of infectious diseases, and driven by the Millennium Development Goals, and much of the focus of that is on HIV, AIDS, TB and malaria, and especially the development of drugs and vaccines for these conditions. So if you look at the list of all the diseases, infectious and parasitic diseases that killed people in 2002, you see up near the top are HIV, TB and malaria. How much are we spending on those? Well, we're beginning to have some fairly accurate data on some parts of this. We know very, very little about what industry spends on these diseases in real time. But we do know what the world is spending on vaccine research, because that's nearly all being funded by the public sector. And you'll see there's been a very steep increase during the last few years, especially due to the NIH funding. But what about some of these other neglected diseases, and particularly these other tropical diseases, largely parasitic infections? Well, they get very little attention. One of the main sources of funding for the infectious disease in the last few years has been the Gates Foundation. It's the main philanthropic source of funding. And you'll see that in aggregate over the last few years, most of the Gates money has gone on malaria and TB. Whereas these other infectious diseases are all below that red line. The main public source of financing for research on infectious diseases in the world is the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases here in the USA. And during a period when the NIH's own funding was increasing from a little over $11 billion to something like $29 billion, research on infectious diseases went up from a bit less than $1 billion to a bit more than $1.5 billion. The overall allocation to the National Institute was significantly greater than that, and mostly fueled by the new funding for biodefense after 9/11. The question now is, if some billions are being spent on health research, how much is enough for any particular condition? And that's quite a difficult question to answer. It needs to be answered disease by disease, and we haven't either the data or the time to begin to approach that question, the answer to that question. But let me just give you a flavour of one way of looking at this, which is to look first of all at the average. And we estimate that for 2001, the world spent about $72 per disability-adjusted life year on all health research around the world. If we then take the three most prevalent infectious disease conditions, HIV, TB, and malaria, which accounted for over 11% of the global burden of disease, we estimate that total spending was around $8.4 per dally. Those estimates that we made were based on trying to add up source by source, country by country, what the world spent on health research. There is a different way of approaching those numbers, which is to use bibliometric data to actually look in the research literature, see what's being published, and from that work out how much is being spent. And that produces a different set of numbers, but they're roughly comparable. And from that data, we know that in 2001... the average spending on conditions like cardiovascular disease and diabetes was comparable to the global average, but for conditions like HIV, TB and malaria was from about a quarter to a tenth of that average. Again, the indication is that for diseases which require some very expensive investments in things like new drugs and new vaccines, the spending is far from adequate. One of the most important new developments over the last few years in the area of infectious diseases has been the creation of a series of public-private partnerships that are mainly tackling diseases one at a time, and have begun to attract substantial investments from various sources and are beginning to create a pipeline of new products. The result is that there has been a very substantial increase in funding in this area. In fact, funding doubled just between 2003 and 2004. And there are a number of projects that now have drugs in the pipeline that are getting towards phase three clinical trials. However, if you look at the sources of the funding so far, it's been almost entirely from the philanthropic sector, from particularly foundations like the Gates and Rockefeller. Only 16% of the funding has come from government sources, and that from principally four countries only. And there is going to be a substantial shortfall, according to Mary Moran's estimates, in how much is going to be needed to see some of these compounds in the pipeline through clinical trials. At the same time, as I mentioned earlier, we've got this new epidemic of chronic diseases growing, becoming the dominant source of ill health and death in many developing countries, including, for example, in the two largest ones, India and China. These are diseases that are driven by poor diet, lack of physical activity, and tobacco use. In other words, they're virtually entirely preventable conditions. And it's ironic at a time when underweight or malnutrition is still the single largest risk factor for ill health and death, that diseases in the same countries that are being caused by overweight, obesity, and so on are predominant. So if you look at the data for China now, for example, for 2004, the four principal sources of death in 2004 in the cities in China accounted for 3/4 of total mortality were non-communicable diseases, and nearly 2/3 of the deaths in counties, which reflects more rural populations, from non-communicable diseases. So there's clearly a bad model there of how to proceed, and a need to go beyond just thinking about treating diseases if we want to get at improving the health of populations in the decades to come. And that points to the need to think, therefore, beyond neglected diseases and to think also about neglected people, and that is people whose health is being influenced by their location, by their degree of poverty, and by a whole range of social hierarchies that create inequities. To the extent that health research can make a contribution to all these things, it clearly needs financing. And at the moment, the largest single source of financing for R&D in the public sector comes from the United States. And as you'll see, the funding has increased very substantially over the last decade, and that's principally due to the more than doubling of the appropriations for the National Institutes of Health. If you ask how the US is doing, although it's by far clearly the biggest contributor to research on health, and look at its contributions to net official development assistance, the US doesn't appear to be quite so generous in those terms. In fact, it's the bottom of the league. What is important to recognize, and again, this point I was pleased to hear was made earlier today, is that developing countries can and must do a great deal to help themselves. This is not just a matter of aid or charity. Developing countries themselves need to develop their own systems for providing the conditions for health for their people. And when we come to health research in developing countries, an important recommendation was made by the Commission on Health Research for Development in 1990, which was that developing countries should spend 2% of their own health budgets on essential health research, and that should be complemented by 5% of donors' health spending being allocated to health research and research capacity strengthening. How well are the developing countries doing? Well, our estimates for 2001 suggested that possibly 4 countries in the world had reached the 2% level. None had when we did a similar measurement 3 years prior to that. Let me talk very quickly about capacity issues, which somebody referred to earlier today. And it's generally seen that new knowledge, capacity in terms of human resources and capacity in terms of institutions are all very important. We would like to emphasize something else, which is critically important if that capacity is going to do anything, which is that there needs to be more capacity utilization. And therefore, one needs to ask the question for each country, is there actually a functioning health research system? Is there a way of connecting what the researchers and institutions are doing with the needs of the health system and the policymakers in the health system? And is that being used to address the real problems of the country? Without that, there is likely to be largely a wastage of resources. And there are a number of countries now appearing as what are beginning to be described as innovative developing countries, which are beginning to show the capacity to carry out research and to take it through to a conclusion. When you adjust for GDP and per capita income and look at the number of patents arising in each country, while the USA and Japan, as you might expect, lead the field, a number of other developing countries are now appearing in the top 25 in the world. And countries like India are also able to show a very substantial cost advantage in the manufacture of health products such as drugs. Thank you very much.
If you look at the developing countries and the G6, I have taken model of China, India, the Brazil, and Russia. It is predicted that in next 32 years, the India and China will take over the Italy, France, Germany, and perhaps Japan also, and will be very near to the U.S. economy and the UK economy combined. Russia will have a lesser success, but will also eventually reach there. But how much will it translate into the spending on health is a question, because both China, India and Russia, the major spending is on defense. And in science and technology, India spends more money on the atomic energy as well as space rather than health. Health and education were the two neglected areas where the spending in countries like India was very little. This year, in the next plan, India has promised that it will spend up to 6% in health and education combined, because it has been understood that both of them, if they don't go together, as well as the social development, if it doesn't go together, the public health goods will not reach the people. However, if we take the structures in China and India, there has been some major differences. In the China, the major investment has been in opening up of a very many new institutes and structures in a very quick span of time and very successfully. In India, we were bogged down by a ban on job, so new institute opening were not that many, and the new intake of scientists was also not that many. And the critical number of scientists per institute in China is 5 times more than India. So realizing that, what we did, that we are opening now 6 public health schools, 6 schools of like All India Institute of Medical Sciences, and 2 more institute of like Indian Institute of Science, and also National Science Foundation, and rotating job of about 1,000 scientists who could be hired and who could be put in any other place. So essentially there's a little bit of competition between these countries, and this competition is quite useful, and it is taking us towards the right corrective measures. The Russia, on the other hand, is in disadvantage in a sense that its growth as far as the scientific institute has not been that remarkable. And it has lost not the young scientists, it has lost many established scientists to United States and other economies in Europe and other places. So it's really struggling, institutional structure-wise, it is struggling. Brazil doesn't have that critical number of the institute, but its spending on health research and is around 2%. It is the only country which has reached 2%. The figure which Steve showed, India was 0.7%. It has professed that by 2010, it will increase it to 5% of the total health research expenditure, but is nowhere near it. Even in China, the health research expenditure is not 2%. Recently, we tracked it, although it might not be very accurate, but it is not exactly 2%. Now, if we look at the growth potential, there is one other factor which impinges on our ability, that the political system. The political system in India is a coalition government at the moment. There are many partners, and each partner pull each other in the reverse direction. Now, our partnership is with the communists, and we are facing a little bit of diverse plans as well as responsibilities. In China, the system is very well known, but it is in contradiction with itself, and it has to evolve to really take all the goods to the poor. Brazil political system is almost always in a turmoil, and it is not a very stable system. In Russia, all of you know, so I'm not really making any comments, but a good stable political system will also be very important for the growth of the institutions. However, if we look at the GDPs of all these countries as it grows and we move towards 2050, India will have a sustained growth pattern for the 45 years, for the next 45 years. It is not only based on the current growth rate, it is on the demographic profile, it is based on the development, it is based on the per capita income, and many, many, many robust matrices that it will, by the 2050, it will have more than 3% growth, and this will be perhaps the only economy out of these countries which will go on growing. However, per capita income-wise, India's growth will not be as good as the other countries. India will have lesser per capita income than the China and Brazil. And US, of course, is always at the top. The pattern of mortality transition and future projections in India for the IMR, we will be reaching certain success. But it will take much more time. At the moment, we have introduced institutionally four major plans, like taking the gentamicin to the village and home level, good referrals, endotoxin busters, the combination vaccines, the prevention of the child death because of the respiratory syndromes, and many other measures to improve the anemia, improve the IUGR, and improve the preterm positions. However, the sheer enormity of enhancing them to the national scale remains an illusion. And what ICMR has done has now produced different modules which will go into the system. For the MMR, India's situation is much worse. We have 400, and we have all the goods for the, like yesterday, Dr. Senanayake said that this was one area where we have no control. We have all the goods, and through the research, we have done a lot of things on the injectable contraceptives, the emergency contraceptives, the safe abortion RU486, as well as the prevention of the postpartum hemorrhage at the home level. Many such things have been tested, modules prepared. However, our pill usage is still dismal, 3%, and majority of these things, again, because the social, we have not been able to change the society, it has been a real major problem. Social and behavior research institution-wise is very new to India and the countries like ours, and we had royally neglected these areas. And that is why, although we have the tool, we have the technologies and means, we have not achieved success in these. And our institutions, although have produced modules, have not been able to expand these. The changes in age structure is again a very important factor. And as we see this, that we will have large number of people, geriatric population, about one-fifth of the world's people around 60 years of age will be contributed by India. And the working age population, which will be on the higher age side, will be again contributed majority by India. Brazil, etc., will have a better go at this. And if we look at it, we are attaining a dome shaped rather than a pyramid shape by 2050. And this will say, this will mean that we will have to spend on children, we will have to spend on adolescents, and we will have to spend on the old age people. What we have done, like an ostrich, we have forgotten our old age people. We have no policy towards providing health care to old age people at this given moment. What are the major problems likely to be faced in India? If we look at this, CVD will increase to 18 million, hypertension will increase to 214 million, the diabetes mellitus will increase to 57 million, every fourth Indian will be diabetic. We will have the largest number of oral cancer because of the oral chewing tobaccos, and of course the mental health will be another major problem. While we move, at the moment the NCDs are 53%, while we move towards 2050, it will be around 67%, and Delhi's loss will be 44%. So this is a major, major challenge. The urbanization has been dealt with. I'm not going to talk about that. The increased number of older people will add on the burden, the chronic diseases, and particularly the increasing incidence of new and emerging diseases. Every year we are facing one, and for 3 months we get paralyzed. Then the social and behavioral changes which are happening, crumbling social support mechanism, because this was one of our strength. We are close becoming like any other developing nation, a developed nation, increased drug abuse, and tremendous amount of terrorism, civil and domestic violence, which goes on. Either there is a riot or there is terrorist activity, and increased prevalence of mental illness, mental health problem, both in the urban and rural areas, is a problem. Now I will take a little example of Indian Council of Medical Research as an institution and how it is tackling these challenges. The British founded it 1 year before they found their own, but they founded some other institutional structures in India. They set up 4 medical schools, they set up 2 vaccine institutes, one in Kasauli and one in Kunur, and they set up a tropical medicine institute in Calcutta, which was very famous at that time, and all of them have disintegrated. However, Indian Medical Research Council, on the verge of disintegration, has somehow or other tried to come out. It set up a huge number of structures, but first structure it stressed up was the nutrition, because nutrition was the major problem in India, and at one time it served a purpose. Almost anywhere in the world you go, the people have been trained by this institute, because this was one of the best training field available. Our other institutes were essentially of the communicable diseases and infection, and it has provided some major help. That is, we have set up a very good surveillance system within our country. O139, along with the ICD-DRB Dhaka, we were first to report. We have a 27-year-old influenza network of surveillance. Huge number of surveillance systems have come out of this network. Apart from this, large number of databases, whether it is the Nutrition Monitoring Bureau or the cancer registries, or the CVD registries, disease burden of communicable diseases, non-communicable diseases, are all coming out of this particular system. This system has also a presence in almost all over India, around more than 100 sites. And one of the things which it provides, and which is very, very important, that it provides in 35 medical schools, human reproduction research centers. Now there are other institutions in India. If you look at the budget, the major institutional structure are the agricultural research, which has the largest number of network, was at one time responsible for Green Revolution, or perhaps was not responsible for Green Revolution, has the largest amount of funding at the moment, but very in the recent review came out very poorly. The Department of Biotechnology has set up several basic science institutes. The Council of Scientific Industry Research has 45 institutes, which make from the aircraft to a large number of the drug development institutes are part of this. And Department of Science Technology has 1 medical institute and one public health institute. Both are situated in Kerala. However, The major problem is this, that 18 of these such institutes which are funding health research are funding the same kinds of research, and there is coordination of these research activity, and the fund flows which we recently saw was not there. Recently, with our review committee recommendations, we have enhanced our budget substantially. It is more than 5 times enhancement. One of the way we have been able to function was to generate external resources. The total, we have generated more resources than our total budget from the external sources, and through these we have been able to introduce lot of drugs. One of our major success with the WHO was introduction of the miltefosine, which we're doing with the Gates Foundation paramomycin. All of these have led into a policy on elimination of leishmaniasis spanning 3 countries. We have been able to introduce 2 new anti-malarial drugs into the market, and at the moment one of the endoperoxides made by Ranbaxy is under trial. We have also introduced a new tuberculosis drug which will bring in the total treatment of tuberculosis to 3 months. Another major area which we touched was that introduction of the new vaccines to India. India institutionally is becoming a vaccine hub. It is producing all the EPI vaccines which it needs and exporting large number of them through UNICEF. We have here, with innovative partnerships, we have been able to introduce two HIV vaccine trials, 2 cholera vaccine trials, 1 a recombinant 1, JE, leishmaniasis, HIB, as well as interdermal rabies. A lot of public-private partnerships with the different partner in the disease control. Our role in disease control has also been very, very important. The human resource development, we have invested in the field epidemiology training, because India has gone into integrated disease surveillance system in its 600 districts, and also MD-PhD program to foster clinical research, as well as putting up programs in the medical schools which will create more people coming to academics, because we are losing them like 9 pins. We have consistently tried to increase funding in our universities and medical schools, because these two have been crumbling very fast. So institutionally we have been able to fund them and enhance our funding. And in the funding areas also, we have tried to put in more money for the epidemiology and field and operational research than we did at the other times. We have been able to introduce the South to South institutional network, which is very dear to Jerry. That is, ICMR has signed with the Brazil and South Africa an MOU, Asia-Pacific Advisory Committee on Influenza, Asia-Pacific Health Research Forum. India is a founding member of the partner of the DNDi, India, Bangladesh, Nepal on leishmaniasis elimination and polio eradication. And how India, in this network has helped, you see in Indonesia, that there was, after many years, there were polio infection. We traced it that they have come from Sudan and Yemen through the Hajj pilgrims. The other institutional networking which has been set up for tackling arsenic, Forum for Ethical Review, linking up with international agencies for the vaccine development, and India, Indonesia, Thailand to conduct training and program in the community control of thalassemia. This is one major program which the institutional network has attempted by putting this at the medical school level with appropriate technologies right from the beginning, or detection, counseling, planned abortion, as well as up to the bone marrow transplantation. And in summary, we will be building up the triple helix where private sector, academia, and public sector research institutions will combine, ensuring that academic and public laboratories continue to explore knowledge frontiers on a broad front, remain reliable sources of objective scientific expertise, perform their role in training future researchers and skilled personnel, implement health research management reforms, improve efficiency of existing technologies, and harnessing new technologies in health research. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you for inviting me, Jerry, to be here. When I received the invitation that this was going to be a brainstorming kind of ideas meeting, I thought it was appropriate to think out of the box a little bit and discuss the issue of institution in a slightly nuanced fashion. And I'm going to start this by making three quotations. I think what we're trying to do here, and I want to quote, we're looking and seeing the invisible. And we have been invited here as leaders, and I suspect that leaders are there to find solutions and create hope in society and not to create problems and misery. I'm not sure we can say that for a lot of leaders today in the world. But one of the things that I think characterizes us as human beings is not only that we are wise, as we are called Homo sapiens, but also that we are Homo modificans. We are able to modify and drive our own evolution, and I suspect that this kind of meeting, it's one of those major sort of cataclysmic event in order to try and change a direction or map a new trajectory. It is therefore appropriate that this brainstorming conference on global health, A Bridge to the Future, is being held here in Boston, and I'm very grateful to be invited and to participate in it. Most of you are aware that the 20th century has just barely passed, and this was characterized by an ethos of silos, disciplines, divergence, and equity. Despite this, tremendous progress was made in improving the lot of humanity. More wealth was created, the human knowledge base was increased, we understand ourselves a little bit better, our environment and our surrounds a little bit better. However, during this tremendous build of knowledge over the past century, a lot of inequity also increased significantly. Inequity in power, inequity in wealth, inequity in social justice, inequity in education and health, between individuals, societies, and nations. I have therefore decided, I think, to approach this whole thing about institution from a number of perspectives, but largely from two perspectives. The first perspective is, in this meeting, I would like to emphasize that perhaps we should construct a common understanding of our definitions as to what we mean about the issues that we have discussed. For example, health, however we define it, I've heard that the WHO definition is limited, there have been other definitions, but in some way or another, we need to understand what we are or what we mean. However we define it, is the end product of many interdependent, interacting, non-linear, dynamic, and evolving factors at the individual level, at the community level, at the societal and global levels. So there are many levels, even at the level maybe of a single cell, I suppose, coming from my background. I think in brief, health is both simple and complex, and we need to be aware of that. Health, having been defined as a product or an end product of something, also becomes a critical factor in enhancing human development and prosperity and become the foundation of good education in society. This multifactorial nature of health, either from access, education, nutrition, either as equity or disparity, requires a multifactorial and a transdimensional approach or solution if we are to begin to close the gap or to address the issue of the gap. However, like many things that we're trying to solve, we should be alert to the potential that in trying to find solutions for the gaps and disparities for equitable global health, more and new, unexpected and unintended disparities are likely to occur, and they should become the new challenge. Most of you would know When the world was starving and people were thin, we thought if we simply fed them, they would become normal. We have ended up now with an epidemic of obesity, and now it has become a new form of malnutrition. We thought that if we increased the wealth or created more wealth, everybody would be richer. What we discovered was the richer would become more richer than the little ones that just moved 1% up, and the disparity has widened, and the cultures of the world have also widened, and the identity. However, one of the things that I thought I would caution right at the beginning as we were asked, what is it that we want to predict? I want to suggest that perhaps we should accept in this meeting as a first stop that we shall not eliminate or eradicate disparities or inequities. But at most, we can move away from the current amoral and undignified state of disparity, perhaps to a different but more humanistic set point and understanding of equity and disparity. Secondly, that in order to do this, we need and should create new organizations and institutions that meet the challenges of a convergent and systemic ethos in education and health. I therefore would suggest that, first of all, we need to rethink a number of concepts that have come out of these 2 days, the notion of developed versus developing. Somehow or another, when somebody says, I come from a developed world, we think it is pure and perfect. And when they say you come from a developing country, it's almost like you come from a squalor. We need to revisit the nature of power relationships at the individual level, at the global level, the types of knowledge systems and the type of knowledge and institutions we want to construct as part of dealing with the inequities and the disparities in global health. I think in this broad introspection, we will have a paradigm shift, and I suggest we should quickly do so. Having given you this background, I now want to deal with the issue of institutions in general that I believe should support this. The world today in the 21st century is becoming humanist. This is largely, I think, inspired by a vision of human rights, social justice, culture, human dignity, respect for diversity, and a better framework for both ethical conduct and behavior, and finally, equity. These are the social elements